Maybe two, he amended, glancing up at the white muslin sky from which the snow was falling faster. I ken where we are. Now it's light. He coughed again, a sudden spasm racking his body, then straightened and handed me the cup and dummy.
Here, Sassenach. Feed the poor wee skookin while I tend the beasts, aye?
Skookin? A changeling? So the air of supernatural strangeness about the whole affair had struck him too. Well, the woman had claimed to see ghosts. Perhaps one of them had come for her. I shivered and cradled the baby closer. Is there any settlement near here besides Brownsville? Anywhere Mrs. Beardsley might have decided to go? Jamie shook his head, a line between his brows. The snow melted where it touched his heated skin and ran down his face in tiny streams.
Not that I can, he said. Is the wain taking to the goat's milk?
Like a kid, I assured him, and laughed. He looked puzzled, but one side of his mouth turned up nonetheless. He wanted humour just now, whether he understood the joke or not. That's what the Americans will call children, I told him. Kids. The smile broadened across his face.
Oh, aye. So that's why Brian and Mackenzie call wee Jem so, is it? I thought it was only a bit of private fun between them.
He milked the rest of the goats quickly while I dribbled more nourishment into the child, bringing back a brimming bucket of warm milk for our own breakfast. I should have liked a nice hot cup of tea. My fingers were chilled and numb from dipping the false teat over and over, but the creamy white stuff was delicious and as much comfort to our chilled and empty stomachs as to the little ones. The child had stopped suckling and had wet itself copiously. A good sign of health, by and large, but rather inconvenient just at the moment, as both its swaddling cloth and the front of my bodice were now soaked. Jamie rootled hastily through the packs once again, this time in search of diapering and dry clothes. Fortunately, Mrs. Piggy had been carrying the bag in which I kept lengths of linen and wads of cotton lint for cleansing and bandaging. He took a handful of these, and the child, while I went about the awkward and draughty business of changing my shift and bodice without removing skirt, petticoat or cloak.
Put on your own cloak, I said through chattering teeth. You'll die of frigging pneumonia.
He smiled at that, eyes focused on his job, though the tip of his nose glowed redly in contrast to his pale face.
I'm fine, he croaked,
then cleared his throat with a noise like ripping cloth, impatient.
Fine,
he repeated more strongly, then stopped, eyes widening in surprise.
Oh, he said more softly, look, it's a wee lassie.
Is it? I dropped to my knees beside him to look.
Rather plain, he said, critically surveying the little creature. A good thing she'll have a decent dowry.
I don't suppose you were any great beauty when you were born either, I said rebukingly. She hasn't even been properly clean, poor thing. What do you mean about her dowry, though? He shrugged, contriving to keep the child covered with a shawl, meanwhile sliding a folded sheet of linen dexterously beneath her miniature bottom.
Her father's dead and her mother's gone. She's no brothers or sisters to share. And I didn't find any will in the house saying that anyone else was to have Beardsley's property. There's a decent farm left, though, and a good bit in trade goods there, to say nothing of the goats.
He glanced at Hiram and his family and smiled.
So they'll all be hers, I expect.
I suppose so, I said slowly. So she'll be a rather well-to-do little girl, won't she?
Aye, and she's just shit herself. Could you not have done that before I put you on a fresh clute? He demanded of the child.
Unfazed by the scolding, the little girl blinked sleepily at him and gave a soft belch.
Oh, well, he said, resigned.
He shifted himself to better shelter her from the wind, lifting the coverings briefly and wiped a smear of blackish slime deftly off the bud-like privates. The child seemed healthy, though rather undersized. She was no bigger than a large doll, her stomach bulging slightly with milk. That was the immediate difficulty. Small as she was, and with no body fat for insulation, she would die of hypothermia within a very short time, unless we could keep her warm as well as fed. Don't let her get chilled. I put my hands in my armpits to warm them in preparation for picking up the child.
Then afash yourself, Sassenach. I must just wipe her wee bum and then...
He stopped, frowning.
What's this, Sassenach? Is she damaged, you think? Perhaps your own silly woman dropped her.
I leaned close to look. He held the baby's feet up in one hand, a wad of soiled cotton lint in the other. Just above the tiny buttocks was a dark bluish discoloration, rather like a bruise.
It wasn't a bruise. It was, though, an explanation of sorts.
She isn't hurt, I assured him, pulling another of Mrs. Beardsley's discarded shawls up to shelter her daughter's bald head. It's a Mongol spot.
A what?
It means the child is black, I explained. African, I mean, or partly so. Jamie blinked, startled, then bent to peer into the shawl, frowning.
No, she isn't. She's as pale as you are yourself, Sassenach.
That was quite true. The child was so white as to seem devoid of blood. Black children don't usually look black at birth, I explained to him. In fact, they're often quite pale. The pigmentation of the skin begins to develop some weeks later. But they're often born with this faint discoloration of the skin at the base of the spine. It's called a Mongol spot. He rubbed a hand over his face, blinking away snowflakes that tried to settle on his lashes.
I see, he said slowly. Aye, well, that explains a bit, does it not?
It did. The late Mr. Beardsley, whatever else he might have been, had assuredly not been black. The child's father had been. And Fanny Beardsley, knowing or fearing that the child she was about to bear would reveal her as an adulteress, had thought it better to abandon the child and flee before the truth was revealed. I wondered whether the mysterious father had had anything to do with what had happened to Mr. Beardsley, for that matter.
Did she know for sure that the father was a Negro, I wondered?
Jamie touched the small underlip, now showing a tinge of pink, gently with one finger.
Or did she never see the child at all? For after all, she must have given birth in the dark. If she'd seen it looked white, perhaps she would have chosen to brazen it out.
Perhaps. But she didn't. Who do you suppose the father can have been? Isolated as the Beardsley's farm had been, I couldn't imagine Fanny having the opportunity to meet very many men, other than the Indians who came to trade. Did Indian babies perhaps have Mongol spots? I wondered. Jamie glanced bleakly around at the desolate surroundings and scooped the child up into his arms.
I dinna ken, but I shouldna think he'll be hard to spot once we've reached Brownsville. Let's go, Sassenach.
Jamie reluctantly decided to leave the goats behind in the interest of reaching shelter and sustenance for the child as quickly as possible.
They'll be fine here for a bit, he said, scattering the rest of the hay for them. The nannies will na leave the old fella. And you're no going anywhere for the present, are you, Avalach?
He scratched Hiram between the horns in farewell, and we left to a chorus of protesting meh's, the goats having grown used to our company. The weather was worsening by the moment. As the temperature rose, the snow changed from dry powder to large wet flakes that stuck to everything, dusting ground and trees with icing sugar and melting down through the horses' manes. Well muffled in my thick hooded cloak with multiple shawls beneath and the child snuggled in a makeshift sling against my stomach, I was quite warm, in spite of the flakes that brushed my face and stuck in my lashes. Jamie coughed now and then, but on the whole looked much healthier than he had. The need to take charge of an emergency had energized him. He rode just behind me, keeping an eye out in case of marauding panthers or other menaces. I thought myself that any self-respecting cat, particularly one with a belly full of goat, would spend a day like this curled up in some cosy den, not out tramping through the snow. Still, it was very reassuring to have him there. I was vulnerable, riding with one hand on the reins, the other wrapped protectively over the bulge under my cloak. The child was sleeping, I thought, but not quiet. It stretched and squirmed with the slow, languid movements of the water world, not yet accustomed to the freedom of life outside the womb.
You look as though you're with child, Sassenach.
I glanced back over my shoulder to see Jamie looking amused under the brim of his slouch hat, though I thought there was something else in his expression, perhaps a slight wistfulness.
Probably because I am with child, I replied,
shifting slightly in the saddle to accommodate the movements of my companion.
It's just somebody else's child I'm with.
The pressure of small knees and head and elbows shifting against my belly were, in fact, unsettlingly like the sensations of pregnancy. The fact that they were outside rather than inside made remarkably little difference. As though drawn to the swelling under my cloak, Jamie nudged Gideon up beside me. The horse snorted and tossed his head, wanting to push ahead, but Jamie held him back with a soft shish of rebuke, and he subsided, huffing steam.
"You're troubled for her?"
Jamie asked, with a nod toward the surrounding forest. No need to ask whom he meant. I nodded, my hand on the curled tiny backbone, arched still to fit the curve of the vanished womb.
Where was she, Fanny Beardsley? Alone in the wood? Crawled off to die like a wounded beast?
Or making, perhaps, for some imagined haven, floundering blindly through frozen leaf mould and deepening snow? Heading back, maybe, toward the Chesapeake Bay in some memory of open sky, of broad waters and happiness? Jamie leaned over and laid a hand on mine where it curled over the sleeping child. I could feel the chill of his ungloved hands through the layer of cloth between us.
"She's made her choice, Sassenach," he said, "and she's trusted us with the bairn. We'll see the wee lass safe. That's all we can do for the woman."
I couldn't turn my hand to take his, but nodded. He let my hand go with a squeeze and dropped back, and I turned my face toward our destination, my lashes wet and spiky as I blinked away the melting drops.
This ends Disc 16. The Fiery Cross, Disc 17.
By the time we came in sight of Brownsville, though, most of my concern for Fanny Beardsley had been subsumed by anxiety for her daughter. The child was awake and bawling, pummeling my liver with tiny fists in search of food. I lifted myself in the saddle, peering through the curtain of falling snow. How big a place was Brownsville? I could see no more than the roof line of a single cabin peeping through the evergreen of pine and laurel. One of the men from Granite Falls had said it was sizable, though. What was sizable here in the back country? What were the odds that at least one of the residents of Brownsville might be a woman with a nursing child? Jamie had emptied out the canteen and filled it with goat's milk, but it was better, I thought, to reach shelter before trying to feed the baby again. If there was a mother who might offer her milk to the child, that would be best. But if not, the goat's milk would need to be heated. Cold as it was outside, to give the baby cold milk might lower her body temperature dangerously. Mrs. Piggy snorted out a great gout of steam and suddenly picked up her pace. She knew civilization when she smelled it, and other horses. She threw up her head and whinnied piercingly. Gideon joined her, and when the racket stopped, I could hear the encouraging replies of a number of horses in the distance.
"They're here," I exhaled in a steamy burst of relief. "The militia, they made it."
"Well, I should hope so, Sassenach,"
Jamie replied, taking a firm grip to prevent Gideon's bolting.
"If we Roger couldn't find a village at the end of a street trail, I'd have my doubts of his wits as well as his eyesight."
But he was smiling too. As we came round a curve in the trail, I could see that Brownsville really was a village. Chimney smoke drifted up in soft grey plumes from a dozen cabins scattered over the hillside that rose to our right, and a cluster of buildings stood together by the road, clearly placed for custom, judging from the rubble of discarded kegs, bottles and other rubbish strewn in the dead weeds of the roadside. Across the road from this pothouse, the men had erected a crude shelter for the horses, roofed with pine boughs and walled on one side with more branches to break the wind. The militiamen's horses were gathered under this in a cosy knot, hobbled and snorting, wreathed in clouds of their mingled breath. Spotting this refuge, our own horses were moving at a good clip. I had to pull heavily on the reins one-handed in order to keep Miss Piggy from breaking into a trot, which would have seriously jostled my passenger. As I hauled her back to a reluctant walk, a slight figure detached itself from the shelter of a pine tree and stepped into the road before us, waving.
"My lord,"
Fergus greeted Jamie as Gideon slewed to a reluctant halt. He peered up at Jamie from beneath the band of an indigo-dyed knitted cap, which he wore pulled down over his brows. It made his head look rather like the top of a torpedo, dark and dangerous.
"You are well? I thought perhaps you had encountered some difficulty."
"Oh," Jamie waved vaguely at me, indicating the bulge beneath my cloak.
"No really a difficulty, it's only..."
Fergus was staring over Gideon's shoulder at the bulge with some bemusement.
"Quelle virilité, monsieur,"
he said to Jamie in tones of deep respect.
"My congratulations."
Jamie gave him a scathing look and a Scottish noise that sounded like boulders rolling under water. The baby began to cry again.
"First things first," I said.
"Are there any women here with babies? This child needs milk, and she needs it now." Fergus nodded, eyes wide with curiosity.
"Oui, milady. Do at least that I have seen."
"Good. Lead me to them." He nodded again, and taking hold of Piggy's halter, turned toward the settlement.
"What's amiss, then?"
Jamie inquired, and cleared his throat. In my anxiety for the baby, I hadn't paused to consider what Fergus's presence meant. Jamie was right, though. Simple concern for our well-being wouldn't have brought him out on the road in this weather.
We appear to have a small difficulty, my lord."
He described the events of the previous afternoon, concluding with a Gallic shrug and a huff of breath.
"And so Monsieur Morton has taken refuge with the horses."
He nodded ahead toward the makeshift shelter,
"while the rest of us enjoy the hospitality of Brownsville."
Jamie looked a trifle grim at this, no doubt from a contemplation of what the hospitality for 40-odd men might cost.
"Mm-hmm. A ticket that the Browns' dinner ken Morton is there."
Fergus shook his head.
"Why is Morton there?"
I asked, having temporarily stifled the baby by putting it to my own breast.
"I should have thought he'd be off away, back to Granite Falls and pleased to be alive."
"He will not go, milady. He says he cannot forego the bounty."
Word had come just before our departure from the ridge. The governor was offering 40 shillings per man as an inducement to serve in the militia. A substantial sum, particularly to a new homesteader such as Morton, facing a bleak winter. Jamie rubbed a hand slowly over his face. This was a dilemma, all right. The militia company needed the men and supplies from Brownsville, but Jamie could scarcely conscript several Browns who would immediately attempt to assassinate Morton. Nor could he afford to pay Morton's bounty himself. Jamie looked as though he were tempted to assassinate Morton personally, but I suppose this wasn't a reasonable alternative. "Perhaps Morton could be induced to marry the girl," I suggested delicately.
"I had thought of that," Fergus said. "Regretfully, Monsieur Morton is already possessed of a wife in Granite Falls."
He shook his head, which was beginning to look like a small snow-capped hillock in his cap.
"Why did the Browns not follow yon Morton?"
Jamie asked, apparently following his own train of thought.
"If an enemy comes upon your land and you with your kin, you dinna just let him flee. You hunt him down and kill him."
Fergus nodded, clearly familiar with this brand of Highland logic.
"I believe that was the intent," he said. "They were distracted, however, by Le Petit Roger."
I could hear a distinct note of amusement in his voice. So could Jamie.
"What did he do?"
he asked warily.
"Sang to them," Fergus said, the amusement becoming more pronounced. "He has been singing most of the night and playing upon his drum. The entire village came to hear. There are 6 men of suitable age for the militia And, he added practically, the two women are avec les, as I said, milady.
Jamie coughed, wiped a hand under his nose, and nodded to Fergus with a wave at me.
I will. The wee lass must eat, and I canna stay back, or the Browns will tumble to it that Morton's here. Go and say to him that I shall come and speak to him as soon as maybe.
He reined his horse's head toward the tavern, and I nudged Mrs. Piggy to follow. "What are you going to do about the Browns?" I asked.
"Christ!"
Jamie said, more to himself than to me.
"How in hell should I know?"
And coughed again. Chapter 32. Mission Accomplished. Our arrival with the baby created a sufficient sensation to distract everyone in Brownsville from their private concerns, be these practical or homicidal. A look of intense relief crossed Roger's face at sight of Jamie, though this was instantly suppressed, replaced by a bland attitude of square-shouldered self-assurance. I ducked my head to hide a smile and glanced at Jamie, wondering if he had noted this rapid transformation. He sedulously avoided my eye, indicating that he had.
"You've done well," he said in a casual undertone, clapping Roger's shoulder in greeting before turning to receive the salutations of the other men and introductions to our involuntary hosts. Roger merely nodded in an offhand sort of way, but his face took on a muted glow, as though someone had lit a candle inside him.
Young Miss Beardsley caused a great stir. One of the nursing mothers was fetched, and at once put the screeching baby to her breast, hastily handing me her own child in exchange. A three-month-old boy of placid temperament, he looked up at me with mild bewilderment, but seemed not to object to the substitution, merely blowing a few thoughtful spit bubbles in my direction. A certain amount of confusion ensued, with everyone asking questions and offering speculations at once, but Jamie's story, edited to terseness, of events at the Beardsley's farm, put a stop to the hubbub. Even the red-eyed young woman, whom I recognised from Fergus's story as Isaiah Morton's inamorata, forgot her grief, listening open-mouthed.
"Poor little creature,"
she said, peering at the baby as it suckled fiercely at her cousin's breast.
"So you've no parents at all, it seems."
Miss Brown cast a dark look at her own father, apparently thinking orphanhood had its advantages.
"What will become of her?" Mrs. Brown asked with more practicality. "Oh, we'll see she's taken good care of, my dear. She'll find a secure place with us."
Her husband put a reassuring hand on her arm, at the same time exchanging a glance with his brother. Jamie saw it too. I saw his mouth twitch, as though he might say something. But he shrugged slightly and turned instead to confer with Henry Gallagher and Fergus, his two stiff fingers tapping gently on his leg. The elder Miss Brown leaned toward me, preparing to ask another question, but was prevented by a sudden blast of arctic wind that blew through the big room, lifting the loose hides over the windows and peppering the room with a spray of snow like frozen birdshot. Miss Brown gave a small whoop, abandoned her curiosity, and ran to fasten down the window coverings. Everyone else stopped discussing the Beardsleys and began hastily to batten down hatches. I caught a quick glimpse outside as Miss Brown struggled with the unwieldy hides. The storm had arrived now in good earnest. Snow was coming down thick and fast. The black ruts of the road had all but disappeared under a coating of white, and it was obvious that Fraser's company was going nowhere for the time being. Mr. Richard Brown, looking mildly disgruntled, nonetheless graciously offered us a second night's shelter, and the militiamen settled in for supper among the houses and barns of the village. Jamie went out to bring in our bedding and provisions from the horses, and see them fed and sheltered. Presumably, he would also take the opportunity to speak privately with Isaiah Morton, if the latter was still lurking out there in the blizzard. I did wonder what Jamie meant to do with his mountain Romeo, but I hadn't time for much speculation. It was getting on now for twilight, and I was sucked into the swirl of activity around the hearth as the women rose to the fresh challenge of providing supper for 40 unexpected guests. Juliet, that is, the younger Miss Brown, moped sullenly in the corner, refusing to help. She did, though, take over care of the Beardsley baby, rocking the little girl and crooning to her long after it was plain that the child was asleep. Fergus and Gallagher had been sent off to retrieve the goats, and returned with them just before supper time, wet and muddy to the knees, their beards and eyebrows frosted with snow. The nannies were wet and snow-caked too, their chilled udders red with cold, milk swollen and swinging painfully against their legs. They were enchanted to be back in the bosom of civilization, though, and nattered to each other in cheerful excitement. Mrs. Brown and her sister-in-law took the goats off to the tiny barn to be milked, leaving me in charge of the stewpot and Hiram, who was installed in solitary majesty near the hearth, contained in a makeshift pen composed of an overturned table, two stools, and a blanket chest. The cabin was essentially one large, draughty room, with a walled loft above and a small lean-to at the back for storage. Crowded as it was with tables, benches, stools, kegs of beer, bundles of hides, a small hand loom in one corner, a chiffonier with a most incongruous chiming clock adorned with cupids in another, a bed against the wall, two settles by the hearth, a musket and two fowling pieces hung above the chimney breast, and various aprons and cloaks on pegs by the door, the presence of a sick goat was surprisingly inconsequential. I had a look at my erstwhile patient, who meared ungratefully at me, long blue tongue protruding in derision. Snow was melting from the deep spirals of his horns, leaving them black and shiny, and his coat was soaked into brindled spikes round his shoulders. "There's gratitude for you," I said rebukingly. "If it weren't for Jamie, you'd be cooking over that fire instead of beside it. And good enough for you, too, you wicked old sod." "Meh," he said shortly. Still, he was cold, tired, and hungry, and his harem wasn't there to be impressed, so he suffered me to rub his head and scratch his ears, feed him wisps of hay, and eventually to step into his pen and run a light hand down his injured leg to check the splinting. I was more than a little tired and hungry too, having had nothing to eat since a little goat's milk at dawn. Between the smell of the simmering stew and the flickering light and shadows in the room, I felt light-headed and very slightly disembodied, as though I were floating a foot or two above the floor. "You're a nice old lad, aren't you?" I murmured. After an afternoon spent in close contact with babies, all in varying stages of moistness and shrieking, the company of the irascible old goat was rather soothing. "Is he going to die?" I looked up in surprise, having quite forgotten the younger Miss Brown, who had been overlooked in the shadows of the settle. She was standing by the hearth now, still holding the Beardsley baby, and frowning upon Hiram, who was trying to nibble the edge of my apron. "No," I said, twitching the cloth out of his mouth. "I shouldn't think so." What was her name? I groped blearily through my memory, matching up faces and names from the earlier flurry of introductions. Alicia, that was it, though I couldn't help still thinking of her as Juliet. She wasn't much older than Juliet, barely 15, if that. She was a plain child, though, round-jawed and pasty, narrow in the shoulder and broad through the hip. Not much of the jewel in Ethiop's ear about her. She said nothing more, and to keep the conversation going, I nodded at the baby, still in her arms. "How's the little one?" "All right," she said listlessly. She stood staring at the goat a moment longer, then tears suddenly welled in her eyes. "I wish I was dead," she said. "Oh, really?" I said, taken aback. Well. I rubbed a hand over my face, trying to summon enough presence of mind to deal with this. Where was the beastly girl's mother? I cast a quick look at the door, but heard no one coming. We were momentarily alone, the women milking or minding supper, the men all caring for the stock. I stepped out of Hiram's pen and laid a hand on her arm. "Look," I said in a low voice. Isaiah Morton's not worth it. He's married. Did you know that? Her eyes went wide, then squinted nearly shut, spurting sudden tears. No, evidently she hadn't known. Tears were pouring down her cheeks and dripping on the baby's oblivious head. I reached out and took the swaddled child gently from her, steering her toward the settle with my free hand.
How did you... Who?
She was gurgling and sniffling, trying to ask questions and get control of herself at the same time. A man's voice shouted something outside, and she scrubbed frantically at her cheeks with her sleeve. The gesture reminded me that while the situation seemed rather melodramatic, not to say slightly comic, in my currently muzzy frame of mind, it was a matter of great seriousness to the principals involved in it. After all, her male relations had tried to kill Morton, and would certainly try again if they found him. I tensed at the sound of approaching feet, and the baby stirred and whined a little in my arms. But the footsteps crunched past in the road, and the sound vanished in the wind. I sat down beside Alicia Brown, sighing with the sheer pleasure of taking weight off my feet. Every muscle and joint in my body ached from the after-effects of the previous day and night, though I hadn't had time until now to think about it much. Jamie and I would undoubtedly spend the night wrapped in blankets on someone's floor. I eyed the grimy, firelit boards with an emotion approaching lust. It was incongruously peaceful in the large room, with the snow whispering down outside and the stew pot burbling away in the hearth, filling the air with the enticing scents of onion, venison and turnips. The baby slept on my breast, emanating peaceful trust. I would have liked just to sit and hold her, thinking of nothing. But duty called. "How do I know?" "Morton told one of my husband's men," I said. "I don't know who his wife is, though, only that she lives in Granite Falls." I patted the tiny bag, and the baby burped faintly and relaxed again, her breath warm beneath my ear. The women had washed and oiled her, and she smelled rather like a fresh pancake. I kept one eye on the door and the other warily on Alicia Brown, in case of further hysterics. She sniffed and sobbed, hiccuped once, and then relapsed into silence, staring at the floor.
"I wish I was dead,"
she whispered again, in tones of such fierce despair that I set both eyes on her, startled. She sat hunched, hair hanging limply beneath her cap, her hands fisted and crossed protectively over her belly. "Oh, dear," I said. Given her pallor, the circumstances, and her behaviour toward the Beardsley baby, that particular gesture made it no great leap to the obvious conclusion. "Do your parents know?" She gave me a quick look, but didn't bother asking how I knew.
"Mama and Aunt do."
She was breathing through her mouth with intermittent wet snuffles.
I thought Papa would have to let me wed him if..."
I never had thought blackmail a very successful basis for marriage, but this seemed the wrong time to say so. I said instead. "And does Mr. Morton know about it?" She shook her head, disconsolate.
Does his wife have children, do you know?"
"I've no idea." I turned my head, listening. I could hear men's voices in the distance, carried on the wind. So could she. She gripped my arm with surprising strength, wet brown eyes spike-lashed and urgent.
"I heard Mr. Mackenzie and the men talking last night. They said you were a healer, Mrs. Fraser. One said you were a conjure woman. About babies. Do you know how..."
"Someone's coming." I pulled away from her, interrupting before she could finish. "Here, take care of the baby. I need to stir the stew." I thrust the child unceremoniously into her arms and rose. When the door opened to admit a blast of wind and snow along with a large number of men, I was standing at the hearth, spoon in hand, eyes fixed on the pot, and my mind bubbling as vigorously as the stew. She hadn't had time to ask explicitly, but I knew what she'd been about to say. Conjure woman, she'd called me. She wanted my help to get rid of the child, almost certainly. How, I wondered. How could a woman think of such a thing with a living child in her arms, less than a day out of the womb? But she was very young. Very young and suffering from the shock of hearing that her lover was untrue. Not yet far enough advanced in pregnancy to show, either. If she hadn't yet felt her own child move, no doubt it seemed quite unreal to her. She'd seen it only as a means of forcing her father's consent. Now it seemed likely a trap that had closed suddenly upon her. No wonder if she was distraught, looking frantically for escape. Give her a little time to recover, I thought, glancing at the settle where the shadows hid her. I should talk to her mother, to her aunt. Jamie appeared suddenly beside me, rubbing reddened hands over the fire, snow melting from the folds of his clothes. He looked extremely cheerful, in spite of his cold, the complications of Isaiah Morton's love life, and the storm going on outside. "How is it, Sassenach?" he asked hoarsely, and without waiting for me to reply, took the spoon from my hand, put one hard, cold arm around me, and pulled me off my feet and up into a hearty kiss, made the more startling by the fact that his half-sprouted beard was thickly encrusted with snow. Emerging slightly dazed from this stimulating embrace, I realised that the general attitude of the men in the room was similarly jolly. Backs were being slapped, boots stamped, and coats shaken to the accompaniment of the sort of hoots and roaring noises men make when feeling particularly exuberant. "What is it?" I asked, looking round in surprise. To my astonishment, Joseph Weems stood in the centre of the crowd. The tip of his nose was red with cold, and he was being knocked half off his feet by men smacking him on the back in congratulations. "What's happened?" Jamie gave me a brilliant smile, teeth gleaming in the frozen wilderness of his face, and thrust a limp crumple of wet paper into my hand, fragments of red wax still clinging to it. The ink had run with the wet, but I could make out the relevant words. Hearing of General Waddell's intended approach, the regulators had decided that discretion was the better part of valour. They had dispersed. And, as per this order came from Governor Tryon, the militia was stood down. "Oh, good," I said, and flinging my arms round Jamie, kissed him back, snow and ice notwithstanding. Thrilled with the news of the stand-down, the militia took advantage of the bad weather to celebrate. Equally thrilled not to be obliged to join the militia, the Browns instead joined heartily in the celebration, contributing 3 large kegs of Thomasina Brown's best home-brewed beer and 6 gallons of hard cider to the cause, at half cost. By the time supper was over, I sat in the corner of a settle with the Beardsley baby in my arms, half dissolved with weariness, and kept vertical only by the fact that there was no place as yet to lie down. The air shimmered with smoke and conversation. I had drunk strong cider with my supper, and both faces and voices tended to swim in and out of focus in a way that wasn't at all disagreeable, though mildly disconcerting. Alicia Brown had had no further chance to speak with me, but I had had no chance to speak with her mother or her aunt. The girl had taken up a seat by Hiram's pen and was methodically feeding the goat crusts of cornbread left from supper, her face set in lines of sullen misery. Roger was singing French ballads, by popular request, in a soft, true voice. A young woman's face floated into view in front of me, eyebrows raised in question. She said something, lost in the babble of voices, then reached gently to take the baby from me. Of course, Jemima, that was her name, the young mother who had offered to nurse the child. I stood up to give her room on the settle, and she put the baby at once to her breast. I leaned against the chimney-piece, watching with dim approval as she cupped the child's head, guiding it and murmuring. She was both tender and businesslike, a good combination. Her own baby, little Christopher, that was his name, snored peaceably in his grandmother's arms as the old lady bent to light her clay pipe from the fire. I glanced back at Jemima and had the oddest sense of déjà vu. I blinked, trying to catch the fleeting vision, and succeeded in capturing a sense of overwhelming closeness, of warmth and utter peace. For an instant, I thought it was the sense of nursing a child, and then, odder still, realised it wasn't the mother's sense I felt, but the child's. I had the very distinct memory, if that's what it was, of being held against a warm body, mindless and replete in the sure conviction of absolute love. I closed my eyes and took a firmer grip on the chimney breast, feeling the room begin a slow and lazy spin about me. "Beecham," I murmured, "you are quite drunk." If so, I wasn't the only one. Delighted at the prospect of imminent return to their homes, the militiamen had absorbed most of the drinkables in Brownsville and were working assiduously on the remainder. The party was beginning to break up now, though, with men stumbling off to cold beds in barns and sheds, others thankfully rolling up in blankets by the fire. I opened my eyes to see Jamie throw back his head and yawn enormously, gape-jawed as a baboon. He blinked and stood up, shaking off the stupor of food and beer, then glanced toward the hearth and saw me standing there. He was plainly as tired as I was, if not quite as giddy, but he had a sense of deep content about him, apparent in the long-limbed ease with which he stretched and settled himself. "I'm going to see to the horses," he said to me, voice husky from grip and much talking. "Fancy a walk in the moonlight, Sassenach?" The snow had stopped, and there was moonlight, glowing through a haze of vanishing cloud. The air was lung-chillingly cold, still fresh and restless with the ghost of the passing storm, and did much to clear my spinning head. I felt a childish delight in being the first to mark the virgin snow, and stepped high and carefully, making neat boot prints, and looking back to admire them. The line of footprints wasn't very straight, but fortunately no one was testing my sobriety. "Can you recite the alphabet backward?" I asked Jamie, whose footsteps were wavering companionably along with my own.
"I expect so," he replied.
"Which one? English, Greek, or Hebrew?"
"Never mind."
I took a firmer grip of his arm. "If you remember all three forward, you're in better condition than I am."
He laughed softly, then coughed.
"You're never drunk, Sassenach. Not on three cups of cider."
"Must be fatigue, then," I said dreamily. "I feel as though my head's bobbing about on a string like a balloon."
"How do you know how much I drank? Do you notice everything?"
He laughed again and folded a hand round mine where it clutched his arm.
"I like to watch you, Sassenach, especially in company. You've the loveliest shine to your teeth when you laugh."
"Flatterer," I said, feeling nonetheless flattered. Given that I hadn't so much as washed my face in several days, let alone bathed or changed my clothes, my teeth were likely the only things about me that could be honestly admired. Still, the knowledge of his attention was singularly warming. It was a dry snow, and the white crust compressed beneath our feet with a low crunching noise. I could hear Jamie's breathing, hoarse and laboured still, but the rattle in his chest had gone, and his skin was cool.
"It'll be fair by morning," he said, looking up at the hazy moon. "Do you see the ring?"
It was hard to miss, an immense circle of diffuse light that ringed the moon, covering the whole of the eastern sky. Faint stars were showing through the haze. It would be bright and clear within the hour.
"Yes. We can go home tomorrow, then."
"Aye. It'll be muddy going, I expect. You can feel the air changing. It's cooled enough now, but the snow will melt as soon as the sun's full on it."
Perhaps it would, but it was cold enough now.
The horse's brushy shelter had been reinforced with more cut branches of pine and hemlock, and it looked like a small lumpy hillock rising from the ground, thickly covered over with snow. Dark patches had melted clear, though, warmed by the horse's breath, and wisps of steam rose from them, scarcely visible. Everything was quiet, with a palpable sense of drowsy content.
"Morton will be cosy, if he's in there," I observed.
"I shouldn't think so. I sent Fergus out to tell him the militia was disbanded so soon as Weems came with a note."
"Yes, but if I were Isaiah Morton, I don't know that I would have set straight out on the road home in a blinding snowstorm," I said dubiously.
"Like you would if you had all the Browns in Brownsville after you with guns," he said.
Nonetheless, he paused in his step, raised his voice a little, and called,
"Isaiah!"
in a croaking rasp. There was no answer from the makeshift stable, and taking my arm again, he turned back toward the house. The snow was virgin no longer, trampled and muddied by the prints of many feet as the militia dispersed to their beds. Roger had stopped singing, but there were still voices from inside the house. Not everyone was ready to retire. Reluctant to go back at once to the atmosphere of smoke and noise, we walked by unspoken mutual consent round the house and barn, enjoying the silence of the snowy wood and the nearness of each other. Coming back, I saw that the door of the lean-to at the rear of the house stood ajar, creaking in the wind, and pointed it out to Jamie. He poked his head inside to see that all was in order, but then, instead of closing the door, he reached back and took my arm, pulling me into the lean-to after him.
"I'd a question to ask you, Sassenach, before we go in," he said.
He set the door open so the moonlight streamed in, shining dimly on the hanging hams, the hogsheads and burlap bags that inhabited the lean-to with us. It was cold inside, but out of the wind I at once felt warmer and put back the hood of my cloak.
"What is it?" I said,
mildly curious. The fresh air had cleared my head at least, and while I knew I would be good as dead the instant I lay down, for the moment I had that sense of pleasant lightness that comes with the feeling of effort completed, honour satisfied. It had been a terrible day and night, and a long day after, but now it was done and we were free.
"Do you want her, Sassenach?" he asked softly.
His face was a pale oval, blurred by the mist of his breath.
"Who?"
I asked, startled. He gave a small grunt of amusement.
"The child? Who else?"
"Who else, indeed? Do I want her? To keep her, you mean?" I asked cautiously. "Adopt her?" The notion hadn't crossed my mind consciously, but must have been lurking somewhere in my subconscious, for I wasn't startled at his question, and at the speaking, the idea sprang into full flower. My breasts had been tender since this morning, feeling full and engorged, and I felt the demanding tug of the little girl's mouth in memory. I couldn't feed the baby myself, but Brianna could, or Masali, or she could live on cow's milk, goat's milk. I realized suddenly that I had unconsciously cupped one breast and was gently massaging it. I stopped at once, but Jamie had seen it. He moved closer and put an arm around me. I leaned my head against him, the rough weave of his hunting shirt cold against my cheek.
"Do you want her?" I asked.
I wasn't sure whether I was hopeful of his answer or fearful of it. The answer was a slight shrug.
"It's a big house, Sassenach," he said. "Big enough."
I said. Not a resounding declaration. Yet I knew it was a commitment, no matter how casually expressed. He had acquired Fergus in a Paris brothel on the basis of 3 minutes' acquaintance as a hired pickpocket. If he took this child, he would treat her as a daughter.
Love her?
Oh, no one can guarantee love. Not he. And not I.
He had picked up my dubious tone of voice.
"I saw you with the Wayne, Sassenach, riding. You've a great tenderness about you always. But when I saw you so, with the bairn tumbling about beneath your cloak, it... I remembered...
how it was, how you looked when you carried Faith. I caught my breath. To hear him speak the name of our first daughter like that, so matter-of-factly, was startling. We spoke of her seldom. Her death was so long in the past that sometimes it seemed unreal, and yet the wound of her loss had scarred both of us badly. Faith herself was not unreal at all, though. She was near me whenever I touched a baby, and this child, this nameless orphan, so small and frail, with skin so translucent that the blue threads of her veins showed clear beneath. Yes, the echoes of Faith were strong. Still, she wasn't my child, though she could be. That was what Jamie was saying. Was she perhaps a gift to us, or at least our responsibility? Do you think we ought to take her? I asked cautiously. I mean, what might happen to her if we don't? Jamie snorted faintly, dropping his arm, and leaned back against the wall of the house. He wiped his nose and tilted his head toward the faint rumble of voices that came through the chinked logs.
She'd be well cared for, Sassenach. She's in the way of being an heiress, Ken.
That aspect of the matter hadn't occurred to me at all.
Are you sure? I said dubiously. I mean, the Beardsleys are both gone, but as she's illegitimate.
He shook his head, interrupting me.
Nay, she's legitimate.
But she can't be. No one realizes it yet except you and me, but her father.
Her father was Aaron Beardsley, so far as the law is concerned, he informed me. By English law, a child born in wedlock is the legal child and heir of the husband, even if it's known for a fact that the mother committed adultery. And yon woman did say that Beardsley married her, no?
It struck me that he was remarkably positive about this particular provision of English law. It also struck me, in time, thank God, before I said anything, exactly why he was positive. William, his son, conceived in England, and so far as anyone in England knew, with the exception of Lord John Grey, presumably the 9th Earl of Ellesmere. Evidently he legally was the 9th Earl, according to what Jamie was telling me, whether the 8th Earl had been his father or not. The law really was an ass, I thought.
I see, I said slowly.
So little Nameless will inherit all Beardsley's property, even after they discover that he can't have been her father.
Well, that's reassuring.
His eyes met mine for a moment, then dropped.
Aye, he said quietly. Reassuring.
There might have been a hint of bitterness in his voice, but if there was, it vanished without trace as he coughed and cleared his throat.
So you see, he went on matter-of-factly, she's in no danger of neglect. An orphan court would give Beardsley's property, goats and all, he added with a faint grin, to whomever is her guardian, to be used for her welfare.
And her guardians, I said, suddenly recalling the look Richard Brown had exchanged with his brother when telling his wife the child would be well cared for. I rubbed my nose, which had gone numb at the tip.
So the Browns would take her willingly, then?
Oh, aye, he agreed.
They kent Beardsley. They'll ken well enough how valuable she is. It would be a delicate matter to get her away from them, in fact, but if you want the child, Sassenach, then you'll have her. I promise you that.
The whole discussion was giving me a very queer feeling, something almost like panic, as though I were being pushed by some unseen hand toward the edge of a precipice. Whether that was a dangerous cliff or merely a foothold for a larger view remained to be seen. I saw in memory the gentle curve of the baby's skull and the tissue paper ears, small and perfect as shells, their soft pink walls fading into an otherworldly tinge of blue. To give myself a little time to organize my thoughts, I asked, "What did you mean it would be a delicate matter to get her away from the Browns? They've no claim on her, have they?" He shook his head.
"Nay, but none of them shot her father either."
"What?" "Oh." That was a potential trap that I hadn't seen. The possibility that Jamie might be accused of killing Beardsley in order to get his hands on the trader's farm and goods, by then adopting the orphan. I swallowed, the back of my throat tasting faintly of bile.
"But no one knows how Aaron Beardsley died except us," I pointed out.
Jamie had told them only that the trader had had an apoplexy and died, leaving out his own role as the angel of deliverance.
"Us and Mrs. Beardsley," he said, a faint tone of irony in his voice. "And if she should come back and accuse me of murdering her husband, it would be hard to deny, and I'd taken the child."
I forebore from asking why she might do such a thing, in light of what she had already done. It was clear enough that Fanny Beardsley might do anything.
"She won't come back," I said.
Whatever my own uncertainties about the rest of it, I was sure that in this respect, at least, I spoke the truth. Wherever Fanny Beardsley had gone, or why, I was sure she'd gone for good. "Even if she did," I went on, pushing aside my vision of snow drifting through an empty wood and a wrapped bundle lying by the burned-out fire, "I was there. I could say what happened."
"If they'd let you," Jamie agreed, "which they wouldn't. You're a married woman, Sassenach. You couldn't testify in a court, even if you weren't my own wife."
That brought me up short. Living as we did in the wilderness, I seldom encountered the more outrageous legal injustices of the times in a personal way, but I was aware of some of them. He was right. In fact, as a married woman, I had no legal rights at all. Ironically enough, Fanny Beardsley did, being now a widow. She could testify in a court of law, if she wished.
"Well, bloody hell," I said with feeling.
Jamie laughed, though quietly, then coughed. I snorted with a satisfactory explosion of white vapour. I wished momentarily that I was a dragon. It would have been extremely enjoyable to huff flame and brimstone on a number of people, starting with Fanny Beardsley. Instead, I sighed, my harmless white breath vanishing in the dimness of the lean-to.
"I see what you mean by delicate, then," I said.
"Aye, but not impossible."
He cupped a large, cold hand along my cheek, turning my face up to his. His eyes searched my own, dark and intent.
"If you want the child, Claire, I will take her and manage whatever comes."
If I wanted her. I could feel the soft weight of the child sleeping on my breast. I had forgotten the intoxication of motherhood for years, pushed aside the memory of the feelings of exaltation, exhaustion, panic, delight. Having Germaine and Jemmy and Joan nearby, though, had reminded me vividly.
"One last question," I said.
I took his hand and brought it down, fingers linked with mine. "The baby's father wasn't white. What might that mean to her?"
I knew what it would have meant in Boston of the 1960s, but this was a very different place. And while in some ways society here was more rigid and less officially enlightened than the time I had come from, in others it was oddly much more tolerant.
Jamie considered carefully, the stiff fingers of his right hand tapping out a silent rhythm of contemplation on the head of a barrel of salt pork.
"I think it'll be all right," he said at last. "There's no question of her being taken into slavery. Even if it could be proved that her father was a slave, and there's no proof at all, a child takes the mother's status. A child born to a free woman is free. A child born to a slave woman is a slave. And whatever yon dreadful woman might be, she wasn't a slave."
"Not in name, at least," I said, thinking of the marks on the doorpost. "But beyond the question of slavery."
He sighed and straightened.
"I think not," he said. "Not here. In Charleston, aye, it would likely matter, at least if she were in society. But in the back country."
He shrugged. "True enough. So close as we were to the treaty line, there were any number of mixed-breed children. It was in no way unusual for settlers to take wives among the Cherokee. It was a good deal rarer to see children born of a black and white liaison in the back country, but they were plentiful in the coastal areas. Most of them